Hey everybody, welcome to the concluding part of November's webinar. This is part three, and the first thing we're going to talk about is hair testing analysis. So thanks so much, Nicola, for sending this in. So your question was around mineral analysis. I want to make sure to address that as well as looking at hair metal testing. So the challenge I've seen research-wise for both minerals and for metals is that it does not seem to be a reliable sample for as far as like a tissue sample as compared to using urine or blood for these sorts of things. So I don't tend to use it for that reason. That's probably why one of the reasons it's pretty inexpensive is because it's not that reliable. One of the things that I've seen in correspondence for metals and hair is that it's theorized that if there are metals, that it could be metals that have been, you know, stored or in the body for long, long, long periods of time and may not accurately represent what's currently going on. So if we do a metal sample for hair, for example, and we come up positive, we don't know for sure if that's accurate or if somebody had an exposure a long time ago and their body's actually been able to effectively clear the metals, as we all have different, of course, processes to the extent of how well we're able to do that. So I haven't seen a same study looking at hair mineral as far as a problem from the longevity standpoint or the long-term perspective around the accuracy of what's happening in the acute. But I have seen research that basically says that it's not super reliable. So I tend to stay away from it as using it because I'm not confident in it as a testing mechanism for mineral analysis. There's not a ton of research out there, but there are a couple studies that have looked at the reliability of it and have not shown very positive results. So I largely question it as a reliable tool, and although it's pretty inexpensive, it's obviously not going to be worth it if the data we collect is inaccurate and then we go down a treatment process or a treatment plan that's not to our client's best interest. So at this point, I do not recommend using that sort of testing, unfortunately, as you're right, it is inexpensive and obviously super easy to collect some tissue samples. So, keep me posted if you guys read anything different, but that's what I've been seeing on that for now. Okay, and then the last thing to mention is that I did already answer the questions the submissions that Grace had done with the case that she submitted, but she did actually send me in a couple more pieces that she wanted to comment on, which was on this wheat zoomer for the client that we talked about already of hers. The total IgG was low, and that's always a really important thing to take in context with the entire picture of a wheat zoomer, because when we're looking at some of these tissue transaminases, when we're looking at the anti-donulin IgG, when we're looking at any IgG, if we have a lower level of IgG as far as the totals, we actually know that this person is having a little bit of a hard time mounting an immune response. So the fact here when we see an alpha beta gliad and IgG that's high, or a alpha gliad and IgG here that's moderate at 0.91, because the body actually has low IgG levels, this could actually be, say, not an accurate representation of where this person actually is. So with low IgG total levels, these levels could be actually falsely a little bit lower than they actually are, meaning we could have somebody that has, technically they should have higher IgG levels than what we see here. So this would, you know, become really important, especially if we had, you know, low IgG levels as far as total, and then we found places that were, say, in control, but on like the high end of in control, where they were almost in moderate. And then we might say that, oh, this person really does have a problem. They just have such low IgGs that their body is showing that they can't mount an immune response. So there is some research about probiotics being able to raise IgG. I've had moderate clinical results with that, moderate meaning I've seen shifts when there are, say, borderline low levels, like in the 800 or 900s, where it's in control but on the low side of control. I have referred a lot of people for IVIG, so it's intravenous immunoglobulin therapy. In Colorado, Dr. Melamed is somebody who does this work, and that sometimes in these sorts of situations can be a really good idea because this person just has such low immune system support that sometimes we just need to give that the immune system that boost in order to get them out of this level. So that therapy does tend to be a little bit pricey, but does tend to be extremely effective. So I would definitely consider that. And then the other thing that you wrote in this email, oh, was just that your client had his house tested for mold prior to moving. He didn't know what type of test that was. So that's a big thing, an important thing. Oftentimes, if they just had their house tested with a random remediator, 99% of the time, what that remediator is going to be doing, that mold remediator, is maybe just testing for dampness and for how humid the air is. So sometimes mold tests are just as simple as that, and they go around and they walk around all the different rooms, and they basically say, "Oh, everything is safe as far as the humidity level." Now, that can tell about the activity of a current mold, but it doesn't really say anything for, say, past previous molds that have grown and mycotoxins that are in the air still causing problems. So while that is a slightly valuable test, we can't actually rule out mold being present or mycotoxins being present in the air just by a humidity test. The other thing that I see sometimes happen is these, and this is also really common with classic mold remediators, is they just take air samples. And they take air samples because most molds are very light, and so the molds they kind of float in the air. But the problem is that really toxic molds are heavy. They don't suspend in air, so they actually would be sitting on countertops and anything that has a surface on it. They fall because they're heavy. So we really need dust samples, and we need dust samples that are collected in areas where the dust has actually built up for, at least a week or so. So there is the possibility of really gathering that those molds come out from the air. So that's really quite important and to understand. And so I have yet to find any mold remediator that somebody has just randomly picked out of the sky or out of the yellow books that has actually done like an accurate sample, so an accurate ERMI or a Hertzsprung test. And so I would definitely recommend, pretty much if I suspect mold illness in anybody, unless they've had an ERMI or Hertzsprung done, I actually go ahead and have them do that because it's just not worth thinking that the house is safe and then starting treatment. And treatment for mold can go slow. So we could be 4 months into treatment and before we really determine that, oh, we're not getting anywhere positively. And then we go back and we find that it's because there's mold in the house. And then we've wasted way more dollars on supplements than the cost of a home mold test. So it's not fiscally responsible for people to do it that way. And certainly then it's obviously very frustrating if somebody has spent all of this time trying to be a very dedicated patient and very compliant patient, and we skip this really important step. So I would definitely not take anything for granted or for sure in any sort of way that as somebody that's a professional mold remediator actually did a accurate test, because unfortunately, the mold remediation world is just not really trained in chronic inflammatory toxin syndrome, or sorry, chronic inflammatory response syndrome and mycotoxin illness. So that's the story there. So I think that's a wrap for November. That completes all of the questions that you guys presented. And make sure that you register and let us know if you're going to be able to come to that December. Is December 15th and 16th from 10 to 6, our next mindfulness meditation weekend. And that is at the office. And all you need to do is just shoot us an email, give us a call, let us know if you're going to register for that. There should also be a link to do so on your dashboard. So if you want to do that, we would love to have you there. We've got some really exciting stuff to share with you guys, especially after being in this mindfulness retreat for the past, I think we're on 25 days now. And so we have about 10 days left here. And it's been really, really an amazing journey and learned a lot that I think we can really share with you guys and help you guys with in incorporating more mindfulness and more tools for a healthy emotional and spiritual balance in your life. So we really hope you join us, and thanks for your flexibility around this webinar. Make sure you do watch all three parts. This is part three, and we'll look forward to seeing you hopefully in December in person for that class. All right, thanks everybody. Keep the submissions coming. Take care.